As this morning also we covered this topic a little bit of a kind of a natural proclivity that we have to, on the one hand, complicate the practices that we're engaged in, and on the other hand, really an extension of that, to become confused by that complication. And as I said this morning, it's not, there's always an interplay which results in this. I'm really good at complicating things. I like to complicate things. And if you sit here and I complicate things and then you complicate them further, we have really painted ourselves in the proverbial corner where it can feel like there's no way out. Indeed, there is no way out. So the only way out is to start over with it. One of the things that can complicate our understanding of the Dharma is also the very thing which we might find the most interesting, which is that the Dharma can be reduced to any of dozens, if not hundreds, of simple principles, any one of which can be the seed for, the basis for all of our practice. But as I said before the meditation this evening, our inclination as a kind of literate culture is to toy with those things interminably. And when we get confused, we don't notice how it is that we got confused. So we tend to confuse it even further. Like the person who's lost in the woods, they tend to wander aimlessly from the perspective of someone on the outside, even though from their perspective it may look like they're traveling in a straight line to get somewhere. Our challenge can be stated in a number of ways. One way is that we find a way to study and contemplate and conceptualize the Dharma and its basis as a support for our practice rather than as a hindrance. Keeping in mind that the experience of the Dharma is preeminent. The conceptualization is actually not a requirement. Like one could attain complete enlightenment without ever having conceptualized the Dharma. But not likely that conceptualizing the Dharma without the experience you'd ever get anything. So it's clear which is the preeminent thing here. It's the experience. So this becomes very clear when we look at the core issue in the Dharma. We ask the question, what are we actually working on? What's the point? And the point, once again, can be reduced to many different things. So depending on who you're listening to, whatever their pet summary is, including myself, that's what you get. So that can also be confusing. So when you listen to various people teaching the Dharma, even though they all may be authentic, they may sound different on first cut. So I'll give you my pet piece on this, which is, of course, the most important. And since we're involved in this program of the three turnings, we You can take a look at the very first turning, the first cycle of teaching by the Buddha, and see that what it was about was the issue of self. The issue of self, the issue of I, me, which is thoroughly experiential, is it not? I mean, we can conceptualize around it, but the real issue here is that we experience being something. It's not just like we have an awareness of experience unfolding. It is my experience. So the first turning was about recognizing that that sense of self, unchallenged, untrained, unbridled in any way whatsoever, becomes the root cause of all suffering. And in truth, that sense that self and our belief in it and all the things that we do around it, the territory that we establish and how we defend it and protect it, nurture it, how that is the cause of suffering at all the levels of suffering, not just our physical discomfort and emotional pain about things. Is recognized by all the traditions of Buddhism, all the way through the Mahayana, the various Zen traditions, the Vajrayana traditions, with all of its visualizations and all. We're continually working with this fundamental illusion. So we could reduce the entire practice of the Dharma to what are we going to do about the question, what are we going to do about this thing? And there's so many things that have been written that are really fantastic these days. Back in the early and mid and even late 70s, you could easily read every book that had been published and have lots of spare time. If you did nothing but read the books that are being published now, you couldn't keep up. They'd be ahead of you all the time. You couldn't keep up. Most of it's not worth reading, but... But, nonetheless, it's just an example of what's happened. What we need to do, I'll state as a fundamental principle that even I heard from Kala Rinpoche back in the 70s and forward from much lesser teachers than he was and others who were as great as he was, and it never really sunk in for a long time, that the study is okay, the conceptualization is okay, even you want to debate the Dharma, it's okay. But when you come to the practice of the Dharma, you must set all of that aside and just engage in the practice. So I'll give you my metaphor, analogy of how this works. This, I remember the first time that I drank a cup of very fine jasmine tea. It was the very best that money could buy. Today it would be about $150 a pound. There were no jasmine flowers in it. I said, how can this be good? There are no flowers in this tea. But the tea smelled like jasmine. So then I became curious. How do they make jasmine tea without jasmine flowers? And what I found out was, they go in the morning and they pick the jasmine flowers that are opening for the very first time. They never opened before. That's the moment when the flower has its greatest fragrance. It is most pungent. They gather those flowers. Day by day they go out and they take all the brand new ones that are coming. And in those days, so today they probably have it all mechanized, but in those days they had a large tumbler. And they would put all these flowers at one end, and there was a screen in there. The flowers couldn't go in, and they put very fine black tea on the other end. And this tumbled very slowly. And the fragrance moved from one end to the other and went into the black tea. And since it was a very fine black tea, the black tea never made it bitter, no matter how long you brewed it. And the jasmine, which normally can get bitter if it's brewed too long, would never get bitter because there were no jasmine flowers, which was the cause of the bitterness. So the analogy here is as follows. The fragrance of your study and your conceptual work with the Dharma can be really beautiful and also entertaining and magnetizing. It's interesting. But you must keep it separate from your practice. That doesn't mean that you have to really keep it separate from your practice, but you must just let the fragrance of that study permeate your practice, not the actual conceptualization of it. What you fill your mind with when you're studying will affect everything that you think and do and say anyway. You don't need to try and keep it separate. It will just do that. But if you bring the two together, you will end up with a bitter brew. So what that boils down to is, I think, an instruction which I for a long time thought was really not really workable, which was just do the practice according to the instruction, stop thinking about it, and just do it. And when I would try that, I would do nothing but think about what a stupid instruction that was. I would totally sink myself with it. And I came to the conclusion that people said that because they actually didn't know why they were doing it. And maybe that was true and maybe it wasn't. But I think actually that's really what it comes down to. Follow the instruction as best as you can. Don't force any other understanding to come into it. Don't resist. Just let it be what it is. Think about it before. Think about it afterwards, all you want, but not during. And see what happens. Okay? Good night. Oh, wait a minute. We have to ponder something. Sanjay.
You talked about the experience of the Dharma and the conceptualization of the Dharma.
Yeah.
But when you say the word experience, that suggests that it was specific. You're pointing to something when you say experience. Are you talking about a state of mystical awareness where you're in a non-dual state, or what does experience mean to you? What that word needs a little refining.
Yeah, you're right. Because when you're reading a book, you're having an experience.
And when you're conceptualizing, you're having an experience.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. How dare you ask such a difficult question?
Right out of the chutes, too.
Yes, actually, the two of these things don't actually separate so cleanly when you really come down to it. I think actually it's an interesting question, because I think it actually doesn't raise a separate issue. We might raise the same issue if I'm reading a book, and Trungpa Rinpoche is saying, "I want you to put your awareness upon perception, not the perception that you have through the five senses, but the perception that arises without the need of the five senses, which might be the memory of your face." Right? I mean, when we're not in the same room together. I'm having an experience there which is separate from the conceptual understanding, even then. But normally, we wouldn't separate those two. But when I sit down now and do the meditation, and I'm meant to sit quietly with my mind on no object and wait for some perception to arise within the mind only, I'm not using words, I'm not using concepts, I'm just remaining still, waiting for a certain experience which I will be able to know when I see it, kind of. And then I'm going to use that experience as the object of my meditation. So there's a kind of unfolding following the instruction, which will have a small amount of conceptual guidance applied to it. But primarily the focus is upon the experience itself, not on combining my conceptual understanding with my experiential understanding. And I think that's really where we get in trouble. We actually make an effort. We make an effort to bring the two together. I'm having an experience here with this perception. I wonder why he limited it, not including the perceptions which arise from the sound. I'm thinking like that while I'm trying to do the meditation. And that's where we really get fouled up. Basically, the meditation gets reduced to another conceptual exercise. It never goes the other direction in my experience. It always happens the other way. And then after I meditate for a couple of hours, I feel like, how is that any different from everything else I do? I don't know how to divide it. I don't think it actually does divide. Question's good, because I don't think it actually does, in our normal experience, divide cleanly. And even when we're talking about in terms of meditation, I don't think it really divides cleanly. But we could say that it's an analog issue. That is to say, we know when the principle focuses on the experience, and we know when the principle focuses on the conceptual. The experience never gets complicated. By definition, complication is in the realm of conceptual. Right? It just isn't there with the experience. Go ahead, challenge me. Yeah.
I have read it.
When you were
Here. Yeah, it's on.
I don't know if this is related, but I have experience with the dance, or when you learn.
Of a what?
I have experience in the dance when you learn something.
Oh, dance! Yeah.
When you go to class and you have these teachers, they tell you that you should move your body in a certain way, another way.
Yeah.
And there's a whole. Then after that, you're completely messed up, basically. You want to dance again, and you cannot dance. So I think maybe with meditation, it happens the same thing. When you're starting to learn new concepts, then you try to apply them, and there's an amount of time in which you really complicate yourself because you're trying to live that experience which is explained or described. And for me, in the dance, is that I just have to let go and wait until the complication kind of disappears by itself. So it's kind of, but it's hard for me to say in that situation, don't think and don't, you know, just do whatever it's in front of you, because I don't know why, but that's how it is.
It's a good point.
So it's just part of the learning process, and I know that at a certain point, if I keep on doing it, then suddenly I forget completely about the instructions and I just dance. That's when the bliss comes, or the happiness comes, or the relaxation comes.
Yeah, I think the issue here is maybe that we need to remind ourselves regularly that bringing these two together, especially with intention, is a mistake. And that the sooner that we can let go of the one, settle into the other, the better. As some teachers will say, we're not going to read anything this year. I mean, I've known teachers who would say that to specific students primarily.
Mm-hmm.
Good to take 1 year, don't read anything about the Dharma. Preferably don't read anything, but don't read anything about the Dharma. That's interesting. Try that. So you're sort of blocked now. I knew one person who was even told, don't go to Dharma teachings. It's like, just when there's a teaching, go to your room and meditate. Don't go to the teaching. Don't read about it. Just do it. So I think those are all kind of ways in which somebody can be encouraged to discover the experiential aspect, which needs to be discovered in order for us to separate the two. Otherwise, we can be the other side of the thing is that I think probably I've known at least 15, 20 people who, after more than a decade, are still identifying the experience of study with the practice of meditation. Actually think they're meditating. Then, of course, at a certain point, you reach this point, you think, 20 years I've been doing this and there's no change. What's going on? Well, it'd be nice to get the news a little sooner. Or not at all, maybe it would be. What do you think, Carol? It's on.
Well, this has made me think a little.
It made me what?
Think a little.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so I walk through in my mind as you're talking, and I think, oh, maybe the hurdle for me sometimes with this is I need to have confidence. So if I start to lack confidence, either in maybe I, you know, forget who I heard it from and forget to remind myself of my confidence in the person who taught me, or maybe, you know, that's where my mind will come in and go, well, just what is that? You know, what is this all about? Or, you know, what is, you know, homage or what is, you know, and then but as you're talking, I think maybe I think it's a lack of confidence when really it isn't. Maybe it's just that's the, I've been hooked and I don't know I've been hooked by a conceptual nature to need to figure something out in order to feel like I can do it. It's that. So I guess the question is like,
can
where do you go? Like, how do you find that balance maybe between really having confidence in what you're doing enough to let go needing to know about what you're doing? Does that make sense?
There's a lot of pieces to the puzzle. I think the idea here is to simplify it as much as possible. There's, as many of us know of this system, the 7-point mind training, which has some really strong meditation systems in it, as well as all of these aphorisms which give us some direction for how to carry our practice between sessions. What's interesting about that path is that the aphorisms don't lend themselves very well, most of them, some of them do, but most of them don't lend themselves very well to conceptual manipulation. And I mean, they're really experiential. They really point in the direction of an experience, right? And I think in a way that's why, one of the reasons why we're so drawn to it, because we have an aphorism which is meant to be used in our ordinary daily activities, in our all of our mundane relationships with each other. And the aphorism points in the direction of a direct experience. Like the experience we have in relationship to others is immediately changed by virtue of that aphorism and our implementation of it. And that's kind of shocking. So it's one thing to have an understanding. Oh, I see, it's my grasping after a sense of self which leads to the relationship being like this. We have all this understanding of it like that. But the relationship doesn't change. So we feel like, what is wrong with the Dharma? It's like, it's not working. And the aphorisms in the 7-point mind training just point directly to, just do this. I love the one in, I think it's in the 6th point, where they say, practice these things, but remain the same. Don't change. Don't change. Which is fundamentally another way to say that is keep your practice a secret, right? Don't tell people. In fact, keep it so secret that they can't even see any change that's happened. And what happens then is it becomes so personal and you can't actually identify with it in the same way, because we discover how much we rely upon the feedback from others to identify. They have to say, "Whoa, your 7-point mind training practice, it's really going good." You know? If nobody will say that.
It's a bad investment.
Yeah, it's a bad investment. In the practice of the Vajrayana, this becomes more poignant, I think, because of the fact that the practices themselves are complex to do, more complex, and sometimes very complex. And it's really easy to carry a lot of conceptual stuff into those practices. It's just, if you're inclined in that direction, boy, this is a feast. But it is not satisfying after a while. You have this kind of nagging sense that you're not doing the practice. And you're actually not doing it. You're still getting around to it, making that transition. So I think the way to approach this can be like the basic, simple practice of shamatha, where we are supposed to put our mind on a particular object, like the breath, to just follow the directions of it, knowing and making an effort to practice to become good at, knowing that I thought about it, now I'm doing it. I don't need to think about it while I'm doing it. I just do it. And when it's done, I can think about it some more. But don't bring these things together with intention. Just do the practice. And I recall the instruction from Boka Rinpoche after he gave a 10-day retreat on the Yidam. And it was so confusing to so many people. There were people there receiving the instructions that it was pretty overwhelming. They were probably in over their head to some degree. And he spent half of the 10 days teaching on the 7-point mind training, which actually was relevant, but not clear why it was relevant. And so people were really frustrated in the end and asking, we need more instruction. We can't go home and do this with this much instruction. But the retreat was over. And so he said, which was a grand piece of advice, but so hard for so many people to swallow, do the practice best as you understand it. So he didn't even say do it right, right? He just said do it best as you understand it, and the truth will reveal itself. He also didn't say when it would reveal itself. Nobody asked. I think they all knew they weren't going to be happy with the answer. But there's something very poignant. So he was the master of practice as experience. And practice was his main thing. And when you went to see Bokhar Rinpoche, you went to see the result of the practice. The instructions were actually, you know, good. But they weren't really what you went for. You could get the instructions in a lot of places. But you couldn't go and see the result of practicing the instructions in a lot of places. So it was a clear point being made. I think this morning I used the example of Mother Teresa. It's the greatest teaching comes from what we see people doing, not by what they say. So take out of history like great beings, Mother Teresa and Gandhi and Martin Luther King, and we can name a dozen other people maybe. It's what they did, it's not what they said. The world's filled with great orators. Hundreds for every one, thousands for every one who actually does something amazing that you look at and say, how does a human being do that? Where do they get the drive for that? And it's always, of course, experientially based. So the practice is really about that. I'll add one more thing to this, which is the issue of questions. When we are contemplating, pondering, looking at conceptual material, there are some questions which beg to be answered and are good to answer. Like, should I think about something while I have my mind on my breath? Like, should I ask the question, oh, is the breath going okay? Yeah, it's going all right. Do I need to do that? The answer is no, don't do that. But the big questions, the questions like, what am I going to get from this while you're meditating? You don't need to ask it, and you definitely shouldn't be answering it. In fact, the big questions, even while you're studying, are better as questions. Their answers are not worth anything. The example I like, many of you know Suvanch, who was here this morning, and we were talking about this. So he's a big conceptual man, working for Intel, designing big circuits and things, responsible for a lot. Very conceptual job. What we do with our mind is what we do more with our mind. You know, we do more of what we already do, in other words. It's very difficult if you spend your days and part of your nights conceptualizing heavily. I'll just put that aside. It's not exactly like the plate that you ate dinner off of that you can put aside. This thing goes right along with you everywhere and just keeps repeating its habits. So depending on what your perspective is, in the world at large, we are rewarded for answering questions, not for asking them. Mostly we could say we get in trouble for asking them. There are a rare few people, like theoretical physicists, and sometimes other great scientists who ask questions that open up decades of research and exploration. And they get paid and rewarded large sums of money sometimes, or at least they get good reference in their biographies. Mostly, we don't get rewarded for asking questions. We get rewarded for delivering answers in the world. That makes it very difficult to recognize that in a spiritual tradition where we're trying to work with the thing that asks and answers questions and rewards them or doesn't, answering questions is anathema to the practice. The question is where the value is. You can hold the question, why am I doing this practice? It's a great question to have as a background to everything that you do. Why am I doing it? But the day you answer it, it's gone. Now what are you going to do? So it's another skill to have. Is it possible to hold a question with no intention of answering it? Not just that I haven't been able to answer it, but I have no intention of answering it. Because by the point that it's relevant to answer it, it's irrelevant. So again, the simplification. Try to keep your experiential practice separate with simple instructions. Try to follow the instructions just as you understand them. I think it is really true. It doesn't have to be accurate, which is why we didn't give any instruction on the breath tonight. Put your awareness on the breath. One could say, well, which way? I've heard five ways. I can put my attention here, follow the breath going in and out. I can put my awareness on the breath coming in and the feeling in my body. I can experience the warmth and the coolness as the breath goes in and out of my nose. I can breathe through the top of my head. Where shall I put my awareness? Well, while you're pondering that question, notice that you're breathing. Anyway, whether you thought to do it or not, follow that breath. Okay, how are we doing? We have time for about 10 more questions. Is it clear? Linda. Oh, I don't know if it'll work. It'll work. Yeah, it'll work.
She might not need it. Maybe I don't need it.
Yeah, don't raise that question.
Oh, I can.
I feel like I have to ask a question since you said you can't get answers. I don't have a question. I just wanted to say that I find it actually very freeing to hear you say, you know, just follow the instruction, the just do it. You know, here in Akitown, the just do it part is actually, I find it really freeing. I mean, I gratefully do that. I just say, you know, I don't have to think about this. There it is. I mean, I don't know that I ever necessarily do it, quote unquote, right, but it is very freeing to just sit there and do it. And it reminded me of, you know, like some Eastern art practices where you...
Art,
where you follow the master and you don't ask questions, you just do it. And eventually you get some proficiency in it simply by following the instruction.
Yeah.
Really not thinking about it and, you know, letting go of the conceptual things. So anyway, I just wanted to say it was nice to hear it again to just... be sort of free of having to think about it and just being allowed to do it, whatever that is.
Yeah, I'm reminded by your statement that for a very long time, when I'd hear about the non-questioning, the instructions and all, I always considered that that's a cultural issue. We don't do that. We question this thing. We want to go into it. We want to find out what it is. I think there's a little bit of truth on both sides there. One is, there's no doubt in history there has been great skillful means in the teaching from the perspective of just do this thing. Because actually, if you have to explore it before you can do it, you're never going to do it. And there's also something from, I think, the side of our own culture where we need to acknowledge that growing up in a culture which encourages, even in certain environments, demands a kind of continual critical approach to things. We've trained our minds in that approach. So no point in just thinking that we can turn that off. There is a way in which we need to learn how to bring these two aspects together somehow. And probably the easiest way is to give ourselves the kind of unbridled access, as much as anybody wants, and we all want something different at different times, access to books and teachings, whatever we want to do with it, and then just learn to put it all aside when we sit down and do the practice. Just do the practice. And like the jasmine flowers, what we studied will permeate that, and that will be best if it doesn't actually come in direct contact with it. Sean, yeah. Oh, we need the mic.
It's not on.
Yeah, I guess as a very new person to practice, I don't know, I feel bad asking this question. But I mean, how do I know if I'm doing it, I guess?
Right.
I don't know if that's different, but I mean, how do I know if I'm doing it? Yeah.
Actually, I think it's a good question.
Yeah.
It's a good question. The truth is that there's a place in between knowing nothing, like I just heard about doing some practice, I haven't heard any instruction. Well, that's not quite enough. And needing to cross every T and dot every I and have it really wrapped up so we feel like I really got this down. There's something actually slightly fishy about that also, right? There's a place in between there where we can find ourselves satisfied, even maybe go so far as to say content with what we have in terms of the instruction, in terms of our understanding. So I remember on a long retreat, our teacher there, who was Lama Tsongtsing from Eugene, pretty much as somebody raised in the culture of Sikkim and Tibet and those areas, didn't like questions. In our culture, we have a different relationship with questioning. Questioning the teacher, questioning the teaching, is taken, generally speaking, as a sign of interest. You know, like good students raise questions. Those who don't raise questions are either brilliant or stupid. It's kind of like that we do need to have a certain amount in order to make some movement. And I remember at a certain point, after about 2 years on retreat, Lama Tsongtsing began to move in the direction of he could take questions. He had such a hard time with it. A question was a challenge to authority. Like, did you say that was green or blue? It was just like, it was to the heart. Like, what, you would ask me that? Like, almost like incredulous. So we didn't ask. And gradually it became okay to ask. And I mean, he gradually came to understand that it actually was not a challenge. It was really like just trying to get clear. And meanwhile, we're getting teachings on the importance of having confidence. Right? So confidence, and where it comes from, is a cultural thing. It's actually not some absolute thing. It's a cultural thing. For somebody, it might be confidence comes by virtue of just hearing the words from this great teacher, I feel confident. Just seeing this person makes me feel confident. Whatever little amount I understand is enough, no matter what it is. One grain of sand is plenty for this entire life. I've known people like that. They seem to do just as well as those who struggle and, you know, go through all this thing. So I think it really is, it's individual, it's cultural. So we need to give ourselves a break at what point can you engage in the practice and feel like, okay, I don't have it all, but actually I have enough? In my own experience, what I've discovered is that this is a very interesting book called Masters of Mahamudra, translated, compiled, really, by Keith Dauman. The non-illustrated book, there's a big illustrated book of it, which really is not so good. It's a condensed book with a lot of pictures. The non-illustrated one, which does have some line drawings, is really better. And what you discover in that book is that these teachings often were given to those who became great adepts in the most crude summarized method that's almost shocking. Like we look at beautiful tonkas that are painted to us in great precise detail as they're defined and meant to be painted. And then we hear about somebody who became a great teacher in India having that drawn in the dust of a cremation ground once. And then their teacher leaves. They never see them again one day. And they just go with it, total confidence. They just go with it and they accomplish it and they become famous for their realization, for their students, for all of these things. And they're written about from different parts of a large geographic area such that, scholars will say, reasonable certainty this person really existed and that these things occurred in a certain way. We have the luxury of just continually looking at and pondering and getting more and more clear. I think in a certain way, it's a luxury that we turn into the enemy sometimes. Oh, I don't remember exactly. Was that green or blue green? You know, was it really red or was it kind of a red orange? Can't quite remember. Was he holding it between these two fingers or these two fingers? Somewhere, at some point, somebody had to say, we're going to call it these two fingers. But was it actually critical to the practice? If it cut through your confidence, yes. So why don't we just protect ourselves from that and start from the place of, what I really need, I need the sense of what this practice is about and what it does. Like, let in my own experience rise up and say, what am I really doing with shamatha? Do you have any sense of what I'm doing? I say, probably everybody has a sense of what they're doing. We know what we're doing with that. If somebody came and said, you would recognize false instruction, I think. If somebody came and said, play your favorite music while you're reading the newspaper and talking to a friend, and that's shamatha, you would say, I don't think so. Most people have the sense. You'll know what it is. So you listen to the instruction. You know what it is. Okay, today we just got the instruction, put the mind on the breath. There was no detail at all. Fine. I can work with that. Confidence. Even beyond confidence, contentment. Content with that. When we get some other instruction for insight or for doing Tonglen or working with the practice of the ultimate bodhicitta and the relative bodhicitta, we never get all the pieces. We're never satisfied. So we need, it's interesting, in the Tibetan tradition, contentment is actually a practice. We don't normally think of contentment as a practice. We think of it as an arbitrary state of mind. How are you feeling today? Well, I'm kind of discontent. Tomorrow you say, oh, I feel content today. It's as if I had nothing to do with it. So in the Tibetan tradition, it's actually a practice. You're meant to actually nurture a sense of feeling. I have enough. I don't need anymore. This is enough. Do I have enough forever? No, but I got enough for the rest of the afternoon. That's good enough. Let's go. You know? I ate enough for today. I have enough to drink sitting here. If I'm reading a text, I got my text. I got the afternoon free. I'm going to do this practice. I'm content now. So now is the time to move with it. Confident enough. Is it clear? Have we confused it? Or is it clear? Do your practice separated from the conceptual as much as possible and work with what you have as if it was all you were ever going to get. If it was all you were ever going to get and you were determined to practice the Dharma, the question might be, how are you going to spend your life? Worrying about what you didn't get or working with what you got? It is amazing. One of the didactic values of reading biographies is different for everybody, I'm sure. But for me, one of the things I've been amazed at is how so many people attained such realization on so little. On so little. So little in terms of clothing, shelter, food, supports of all kind. So little in terms of instructions, like a day. I don't care who that person is. One day, I can't imagine who that would be that would make me feel like, that's enough. I can go with that for the rest of this life. And thanks for the drawing that the wind just blew away. You know? It's like, but they did.
Maybe they didn't think their lives would be very long, so they felt like that was plenty.
Good enough, yeah. I don't know. A lot of examples of like building confidence, secret practices, despair, failed attempts at suicide, followed by meeting some great teacher, who then puts some simple question to him. Well, I know you can kill yourself if you want, but if you'd like to be free of the despair, I'd be willing to tell you how to do that if you'd be willing to try. Simple things. Tiffany, and we're done.
Okay. So I just had a question about this confidence. Maybe you could.
The what?
This confidence piece.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't hear the providers.
Oh, we don't have a. Yeah, you need the microphone.
Maybe what? You could provide a specific instruction around what if your confidence is shaken because of a more fundamental sense of incompetence.
Sense of what?
Incompetence.
Oh, incompetence. Yes. Or inconfidence.
Incompetence.
No, well, you're just not incompetent. So we need to look. You walk, you eat, you think. Reasonably clear. You can speak. You can see our senses are intact. In the list of things that are necessary in order to practice, fundamentally we say sound of mind. Actually, what that means is, very simply, we're not stark raving mad. I mean, the bar is really low for this thing. Really low. Well, I mean, it's true. There are individuals who will not be able to practice the Dharma. They are too crazy. The physical being for whom the Dharma was designed is just not intact. Still, there's things for them to do. It's not like there's nothing for them to do. But I would say this is just not the case for you. I can say that with some confidence, even. I have enough confidence for both of us. I'm serious. So it may be that there are areas of lack of confidence or competence, but in this particular case, what we're being asked to do from the experiential side is actually very easy to do. May not be easy to accomplish. It may take a long time to accomplish. To actually engage in the practice is not really any more difficult than going out on the street and finding your car and starting it up and driving home. So I think that's important to recognize. It's not the challenge of great ability here. The challenge is one of perseverance. Before we lose the merit.
By this virtue may I quickly realize Mahamudra and establish all beings without exception in this state.